In much of the world, today is celebrated as International Workers' Day or Labor Day. Here in the U.S., of course, Labor Day is celebrated as the first Monday in September.
Paul Secunda joins us now to talk about why and to compare the labor movements in the U.S. and abroad. He's a professor of law and director of the Labor and Employment Law Program at Marquette University Law School. And Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back. Great day to be back.
Well, and Paul, let's start with the basics. What is International Workers' Day?
So International Workers' Day, also known as May Day, is basically about commemorating, celebrating trade unionists and their successes in bringing leisure time back to the working class. 8-hour workday, the weekends, things that we take for granted today. The original International Workers' Day was a protest by socialists and communists. Interestingly enough, against the conviction of 8 radical labor activists in connection with Chicago's Haymarket Square riot all the way back in 1886. And since then, it was subsequently appropriated by the Soviet bloc through the 1980s. And now more recently, it's taken on an immigration orientation with all the immigration issues that we have floating around.
And so given that backstory, why is it celebrated late in the summer instead of today in this country?
Well, in this country, I think initially we did not want to be associated with the Soviet bloc. So we didn't want to be seen as celebrating anything that socialists and communists were being, that were celebrated. And so instead, they used it as kind of an end of the summer ritual, the end of the holiday, the beginning of work. And of course, most importantly, as you probably know, you can't wear white after Labor Day now.
Those are interesting things to think about when you look at the global picture. So looking at nationwide, is it a celebration or is it an observance? How is it observed elsewhere?
Well, I think it is a celebration and an observance. Elsewhere, it is observed like it is here with marches, parades, celebrations, but it's also a march for immigrants' rights. Today, I've seen that there's an estimated 259 events planned in some 200 cities, including Washington, D.C. Interestingly, some of the larger employers, some of the social media employers, Google and Facebook, have given their employees the green light to protest today without fear of punishment. So I think employers understand this is a good way to allow their employees to vent their concerns that they have and to also celebrate all the great work that workers do around the country.
And you mentioned the Immigration Association and some ties here in this country. Is that also true abroad? Does it have that Immigration Association elsewhere?
Well, I can only speak about a few countries in that regard. I did live in Australia a couple of years ago. Interestingly enough, they have their Workers' Day in March for their own reasons. So everyone has, you know, different dates sometimes and not always May Day. But similarly there are immigration issues as far as people immigrating to Australia and there being all sorts of laws and regulations making it difficult. So I have seen immigration protests in Australia. Canada, which actually also has its Labor Day in September, doesn't have the same immigration issues currently that we do. So it's not as a big of an issue there.
If you look at the United States and Wisconsin in particular as part of this big picture, it seems as though the labor union or the labor movement, I should say, is in decline from some perspectives. Is this also the case elsewhere?
Well, it's certainly true here in Wisconsin and the United States. Both in the public sector and the private sector, union density has declined over the last 20 to 30 years, and maybe most dramatically over the last 5 years. It is true in some of what I will call the other Commonwealth countries, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, although there are other countries, in particular the Scandinavian countries, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Denmark. Easy for me to say. Where there's been high union densities for a long time, and these are some of the most successful economies. I would say that even in those countries that have lower union rates, not as many or as low as ours, for instance, whereas our overall union density rate for the private sector is about 6.5% right now, In Canada, it is closer to 17% and about 15% in Australia. So even though other countries have seen a decline in union membership, union activity, I think that the most precipitous drop has been here in the United States.
So what factors do you see behind that shift? And do those factors also align with what you're seeing in other countries who may have a higher union density than we have but also are seeing a decline?
Yeah, I think it has to do with the role that the employers play. In a lot of other countries, employers do not take an active role in whether or not workers organize. Also, the government's involved, and the government being involved lends an air of neutrality. And so it's not as political in other countries. Here, employers, with a few exceptions, are very anti-union. One of the parties, the Republican Party, is extremely anti-union as far as passing various types of laws, so-called right-to-work laws, laws that make it hard for unions to collect dues from members. So I do think it's a much more adversarial relationship here among labor and management. And to be frank, management has been winning, and the laws and the decisions have really favored corporate interests in the last decade or so.
We're talking with Paul Secunda right now from Marquette University Law School, talking about the labor movement in the U.S. compared to the rest of the world on this International Workers' Day. And, Paul, if you look at, say, politics and who's in control, which party, you can often say, well, politics has a cyclical nature to it, or a pendulum, that it swings from one side to the other. Is the same true of the rise and fall of unions, or is it more of a straight line going up and down?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it depends on what our time period is. Since the early 1980s, it's been going pretty much straight down, even though, of course, there's been both Democratic and Republican presidents. I think this has to do both with the global nature of our workplace, the fact that the American labor law has last been changed in 1959. So you're talking about almost 60 years without any change in the labor law. The labor law that we have today was put together at a different time during the New Deal in the 1930s when we had a very different economy. And I think what we really need is labor law reform, but because the two parties are at loggerheads and they can't agree on anything, we haven't had labor law reform in a very, very long time. And I think this has really caused significant harm to any kind of meaningful union density increase in the United States.
Yeah, can you talk a little more about that? So 60 years since we've seen changes in labor law in this country, what problems do you see associated with that? Maybe on both sides, on the side of management, on the sides of workers?
Well, for me, the biggest problem is just the inability to sit down and compromise and hash out problems. Through a collective bargaining contract, through investigations and fact findings and mediations, you could resolve an issue fairly quickly without hard feelings and get back to work. Now, because these mechanisms have broken down and there are so few unions, we're seeing a lot more litigation. And litigation is not only expensive and time-consuming, but it also causes a very adversarial relationship in the workplace between those who are in management and those who are rank and file. So I do believe that the loss of the labor contract, the loss of unions, has led to more difficulty in managing disputes in the workplace and leads to really resources being spent in ways where they could be spent better as far as, you know, making the company profitable and raising the wages of workers.
And you were mentioning Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and that they had a more union membership and also strong economies. Are there takeaways to compare here to the United States economy, or is it apples and oranges?
No, I think there are takeaways. I think there's this belief in our country that if you have a union, management will lose power and they will become inefficient because they won't be able to run the workplace by themselves. But I do believe that when workers are involved, it's not a static pie. In other words, it's a win-win situation. Workers get involved, they become more productive, their morale increases, there's more for everyone to share. And I think the Scandinavian countries show that, and I also think that there are other countries who are doing quite well, like Germany, who also have very active, if not unions, kind of representational bodies, we call them work councils in Germany, that have proven to be very successful in harnessing that energy and making both the economy strong and making a little bit more equitable as far as how the profits are shared between the two groups.
So looking ahead into your crystal ball, what do you see for the future of unions? And you said, you know, politicians at loggerheads about this right now. So what is the path forward? What do you see?
Well, for the next, administration, I think we're going to see more pressure on unions to find their way on their own, because we're likely to see unfriendly labor legislation, unfriendly people on the National Labor Relations Board. Unions are going to have to come up with new ways to persuade workers that joining their ranks is in their best interest. And I think that requires a new dialogue, a new understanding of what unions can do for workers. It's not just about what they can do for you in the workplace as far as wages and benefits and working conditions. It's also providing other types of services that people are interested in, whether it's buying a first house, being able to get a credit card with a good interest rate, or learning how to save for retirement. These are all types of services that unions can provide and be a voice for the workers in the global workplace of the 21st century.
And Paul, as we wrap up, do you see that happening, that appetite for innovation on the part of labor unions?
Oh, absolutely. Unions are talking about this at every conference they're having that I've been to, at least in the last 5 to 10 years. The best minds are at work to consider how to get workers back involved in the workplace debate. Because let's face it, without workers involved, what we're likely to see is more income inequality, and that's just going to cause more upset in the workplace.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
That was Paul Secunda, professor of law and director of the Labor and Employment Law Program at Marquette University Law School.